the Commerce Committee. When we recessed, we were under a work session on Senate Bill 1149. First off, I want to ask unanimous consent that Representative King can vote on the Dash 18 amendments. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative King, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative King votes aye. First off, we're going to ask Jason to come up and make some brief comments on the BOMA amendment.
Representative Hill, while they're coming up, if I could, I think that some people at our Friday meeting may have thought that I felt that the meeting was being cut off prematurely, and that was not the case. I knew that we were ending at that point in time. I just wanted to have urging of the speaker to give us more hearings time, for the show. I was aware and in agreement with the ending time of the meeting. Thank you.
Representative King. Jason, briefly.
Yes, very briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to highlight one of the 2 points that Chairman Ekus was making on the cost of service rate and the ability for large customers to switch back and forth. He made 2 points. One, it might inhibit the development of the market, and second, that it might make the cost of service rate more expensive. For the record, by the way, I'm Jason Eisor for Citizens Utility Board, representing residential customers who will be the main group that is still on the cost of service rate. And the only point I really wanted to make was I tend to agree that if the utility is supposed to reserve contracts or assets to maintain a cost of service rate for large customers going back and forth, that will be a pretty, I think, a more expensive rate. And all I'm trying to say here is that as a person on the cost of service rate, I would like to segregate the cost of the large commercial cost of service rate with those customers. I don't want the cost of service rate for residential customers to be the place of last resort where various costs will be dumped into. There's also the issue of if all the costs of the large commercial cost of service rate go into the rate, there is a possibility that what you're doing is stranding the utility with those costs because I don't want to pay them. And if a bunch of commercial customers create this cost of service rate and then they flee, someone has to pay those. And what you may be doing, if we're not careful, if the rules aren't set up right, is creating a cost of service rate with costs of the utility that no one is there to pay for. So that was the other issue I was going to mention was the commercial self-direction. But my understanding is that Ann Fisher, in her revision amendments, is going to take that element out. So I can save time. Thank you.
So you're okay with it? Would that be removed?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Gary, you want to come up and walk us through the Dash 22 amendment? Representative Montgomery?
Just for the record, if we could have repeated again who the coalition is, because we've had 75,000 amendments. Are they all part of the coalition, or is it just a group different? And who belongs today?
Yeah, okay. Who belongs to the coalition today? Thank you. Welcome,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very much for that warm and congenial introduction. I'm Gary Conkling, and I represent the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. And we'll try to be the moderator of the a group of people who have worked on Senate Bill 1149. They include industrial, commercial customers, as well as advocates on behalf of residential customers. They include people from the renewable energy community, people from the low-income community who have a strong interest in particularly low-income weatherization and in low-income heating assistance issues. Includes PGE. We have also included in our coalition, particularly as we've moved forward these amendments, customer-owned utilities. We have worked with a mix of individual groups to the extent possible. We've incorporated their amendments. For example, there's an amendment in here that represents issues related to Idaho Power. We also included an amendment from the IBEW at its request. I know it has two amendments. One of the two amendments is actually incorporated in here. And we have attempted also to coordinate our efforts with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I'm sure I've left someone out. And it's fair to ask the question of whether or not this coalition has remained in place. And I would only say that even among the people who are supporters of this bill, there are, in fact, real significant competing interests. We don't all represent the same interests. We never actually suggested we ever did. But what we have said is that there are, particularly flowing from interests that start with customers, a basic set of issues that represent, in our view, the core of Senate Bill 1149, which is, to repeat what I said the other day in our introduction, to provide a competitive market for those customers that can most readily and quickly benefit and who have the skill and capability of taking advantage of market conditions that can provide not only price benefits, but service and other innovations that a competitive market can deliver. At the same time, it provides protection for residential customers while giving them a low-risk set of options that can move them as they see fit and in their time frame towards the advantages of a competitive marketplace that might exist for them, while at the same time remaining, keeping them in an effect aggregated form, so for all intent and purposes they have the benefit of a large pool to deliver the best cost of service rates possible. So in essence, that is what has driven our group together. We have attempted to work with everybody. We've attempted to try to accommodate as many people as we can. We have succeeded in some cases and not succeeded in a few cases. And we wish that we could have succeeded with everybody, but at some point, competing interests are competing enough that you can't come to resolution. It's unfortunate, but that's where we stand today. The groups that I described supported Senate Bill 1149 as it came out of the Senate, but most people with the understanding that there were tweaks, language fixes, some contradictory language, and a few policy edges that needed to be buffed off. The Dash A22 amendments, which are similar and just slightly expanded from the A13s that were shared with you last week, and if you compare them, you can see there are a few differences because we hadn't finished all of our negotiations. We have now finished them, and the A22s and a engrossed document that represented the very last of the commitments that I think you also have represent in their totality the coalition's consensus amendments. And by that, I mean is that if we could reach consensus, they're in here. If we couldn't reach consensus, they aren't. And all of us had something that didn't quite make it. So we could all show you our dustbin where some of our bright ideas currently reside. But nonetheless, these represent those things that we could agree on. And the chairman suggested that I only give a quick overview, and I'll do that if I may, just pointing out a couple of areas that are more than kind of just house cleaning. For example, on page 2, line 19 and 20, in referencing what will be included in a stranded cost determination, you'll see the phrase, and workforce commitments. This is the amendment that I referred to a moment ago that IBEW asked us to consider, and we considered and agreed to. the language as it was contained in Senate Bill 1149 as it came across, because it had some language, it gotten put together, had some problems with respect to the Idaho Power situation. So on page 2, lines 27 through 30, relate to making sure that if Idaho Power moves into a competitive environment, it is not exempted from the competitive rules, essentially, in our own market. In other words, we aren't creating for it some special enterprise to compete in this state. On page 4, starting on line 3, you'll see language that we put in working with our partners dealing with low-income issues, heating assistance issues, to make sure that the monies were appropriately placed and the priorities for those dollars were appropriately identified. On page 4, on line 23, issues were raised about the potential of, as we're dealing on an ongoing basis under existing Public Utility Commission policy, with the issue of rate disparities between different customer classes. We put in language here to make sure it's very clear that rate shock is to be dealt with and mitigated, and it's something that the commission would do in any case. You heard the commissioner indicate that it would do that, but we included specific language to make sure the bill references it. And finally, I would note on page 8 and extending to page 9 is language that PGE recommended, though its applications apply both to PGE as well as to Pacific Core, that are, I think, significant and material and appropriate, which is that for the utilities, as they proceed towards implementing direct access, they may incur both economic as well as uneconomic costs, and that if for some reason this act and the direct access provisions are aborted, that these provisions guarantee that they can recover those prices. In other words, their shareholders are not stuck with those costs. And as customers, we're the people that will pay for it. And we're agreeing, we think that's an appropriate thing for the utilities to request and, in fact, to recover in their rates. I might just add that the reason for this last piece of paper here, which I may let someone else actually explain, is that the world we live in today has certain competitive issues, and what we're trying to make sure is that we, in creating a new world, don't forget the world we currently are in either. And so these are fairly carefully negotiated language that relate to some fairly specific circumstances. And the reason why you've seen a little of us have some grave-looking faces the last couple of days is that this has been hard-fought territory to make clear to everybody's satisfaction. And others can explain it to you. I think people are quite satisfied with it, and I'm sorry that it took us as long as it did, and in fact that we had to perhaps surface in front of you that we hadn't quite come to that agreement. But nonetheless, it's an important part of the assurances for both customers and utilities that we reach this language. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll let you either ask questions or we can...
We'll take questions at this point. Thank you, Gary Ripson.
Thank you. Just a quick question on the coalition. Dash 23 amendments, your coalition endorses them, that we will now have a tax or a fee on residential and businesses. Is your coalition in favor of that?
I'm not sure, Representative Montgomery, which amendments are you asking?
I'm not either, quite frankly. No, the Dash 23 amendments that we approved earlier that set a fee on every resident business in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Montgomery, in the bill, Senate Bill 1149, there are provisions that relate to low-income heating assistance that are associated and connected with when they start at the date of direct access. And we believe that, in fact, dealing with this issue in that context is appropriate. The issue arose in our coalition about starting low-income heating assistance via this means in this bill earlier. And while many individuals support low-income heating assistance, and I myself personally am a former board member of Oregon Heat and have a great deal of sympathy with this, there was not a consensus among our group that this provision in this bill should start before direct access. So the reason it wasn't in our consensus amendments is that we didn't have consensus.
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Is that a yes or a no?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montgomery, we've agreed to low-income heating assistance with that program as included in Senate Bill 1149, starting at the date of direct action.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, they endorse Dash 823 amendments. That's what I was trying to get, so thank you.
Representative Montgomery, I believe you misunderstood him.
Well, that makes that clear.
But I don't. If I heard him correctly, I don't believe he is opposing them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I noticed that you've already passed them, so perhaps
that is correct.
Whether I supported them or opposed them wouldn't be relevant. Absolutely. But since you asked the question, the answer is the reason why we didn't propose that language was that we did not have agreement to propose
amongst the coalition members.
And at last point, we're sitting on this side of the table, and you're sitting on that side of the table.
Really?
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, just for clarity, and I was out for a second.
Yeah.
This is new proposals to the Dash 22s, A22s.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckert, that's correct. And there were, in an earlier version of these consensus amendments, some other language that this will replace.
And so this is down in council?
Yes.
Being worked.
And I should have added, Mr. Chairman, I spoke with Legislative Counsel, Mr. Crane, who did review the language as you see it as we submitted it, and he noted that it was, in his words, nearly close to proper style and form. So I think when you ultimately see it, it won't look much different than that. So it's conceptual today because of the timing of its being sent to LCA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have Mr. Chairman, there were some things that had been included in the language that was submitted to Legislative Council with other consensus amendments on May 10th, but were left out of the Dash 13 amendments. And we had since, the Commission had since talked to Legislative Council about these, and they represent three technical amendments which we've attached. And my apologies for not running these by other folks, but I think they do. What they represent are things that were included in consensus amendments before, but Legislative Council didn't include them, and we've since talked to Mr. Crane and worked out the reasons why they weren't included, and have the technical amendments that Mr. Crane has said are fine. The first one is in Section 14. It adds, we had sent down several times language that said a person or entity shall not act as an electric service supplier, and use person or entity in this section that provided for certification and establishing of rules. The definition of energy service, electricity service supplier, previously in the bill says a person or entity. And because person in the PUC statute is defined as a specific definition, that excludes some entities. We talked to, and because this statute was going to be inserted in PUC statutes, Mr. Crane agreed that using person or entity in this section, consistent with the definition of person or entity of electricity service supplier earlier in the bill, was a proper way to go. In section 14, we kept sending down language to make sure that it said that we could revoke an electricity service supplier's certification for failure to comply with applicable laws, and we kept saying applicable laws and rules, and we worked out what some of the differences between of meaning were, and Mr. Crane agreed that for our purposes, that language that said statutes and rules was appropriate, so it was clear that rules were included. And then the third is just a technical amendment, because I think the PGE meant some PGE amendments had been adopted, and they had changed the subsections, and the subsections didn't get correctly changed in the previous amendments. So the third one is another technical amendment changing, correcting the reference. And we've run these by legislative council, and they represent things that the coalition had previously included. And I just wanted to give these to the committee and let them know that Mr. Crane had accepted them, and we're assuming that unless there's any problem, that they would be incorporated in. Should the dash 22 amendments or the sections that already exist be adopted, that Mr. Crane would make these changes?
Is someone in the committee, did you get this drafted, or who gave the permission to get it drafted?
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, Gary Conkling representing ICNU. In the original consensus amendments, there was language relating to this subject, and this language replaces that earlier language.
Right. I just want to make sure that we understand whether it's been submitted or not, make sure we have a proper note to get it done. Right. We'll get it done. I just want to know if it's already been sent down.
Mr. Chairman, under the prior note, Mr. Crane was aware of it. And just to confirm, incidentally, since I have been the kind of gopher here on the language, Mr. Ekus is quite correct. Legislative Council, the issues that he identified were issues that had come up, and Legislative Council had made determinations that I think upon talking with the Commission have modified. So they actually, the things that Mr. Ekus has described here were actually originally submitted in our consensus amendments. They're coming out in effect the way they were originally submitted.
Representative Witt?
Gary, if I can just be clear, are the issues that Commissioner Ekus just addressed, are those going to be addressed in some new consensus amendments and incorporated in this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, in fact, that the issues that he noted in his testimony just now were actually words that were submitted originally to Legislative Council because of style and form issues, for example, around the use of the word person as an all-encompassing term, where the word entity was not included. They have a particular statute that references both person and entity. So for their statutes, for this language to cover, they need to use both terms. But the truth is that the actual original submissions we made to Legislative Council, they are roughly what Mr. Ekus is just now submitting. So they've already been there, is what I'm trying to say.
Representative King?
Maybe it's for the commissioner, but how does entity differ from person?
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, our statutes define, we have a particular definition of person. I don't have the statutes in front of me, but it doesn't include all entities that are electric companies or that are electric utilities, nor that might be electricity service suppliers. We wanted to make sure that we really wanted to avoid any future legal questions arising over what person meant as legislative council had intended it as all-inclusive, as opposed to person under our existing statutes, which wasn't all-inclusive, and that the purpose of that in fact in the bill, in the section on definitions where it defines electricity service supplier, it says a person or entity, and yet in the section which we were talking about as far as certification, it only says a person. And we thought that it would make it, Mr. Crane agreed that it would not only make it consistent with the definition of electricity service provider, but would avoid any confusion between our existing definition and our existing statutes of person, which was not all-inclusive, compared to what he had intended. He had thought use of person would be all-inclusive.
I assume that you're referring to the ORS statute, commission.
Yes, ORS statute side. 757-something.
It's my understanding in ORS that a person is understood to mean human beings and corporations, therefore entities must mean some other type of legal. Suppose that would be like a sole proprietorship or a partnership.
Or,
Representative Phoenix, I believe Commissioner Ekus is in their particular statutes and their chapters, it's defined differently. That's why this makes the change, because this bill is being placed in those statutes.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you. Now, you've all had an opportunity to read and look. Who would like to come up and make any comments? Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Catherine McDowell, counsel to Pacific Corps, and I guess I'm here to suggest that the term consensus amendments may be a little overbroad. We have several issues with respect to these amendments that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention. One of our concerns about this bill that we've testified to is that there is unfairness in the way consumer-owned utilities are treated vis-a-vis investor-owned utilities. And we see these amendments as not only not addressing that issue and not doing anything to level the playing field, but actually going the other way, exacerbating that unfairness. And there are three particular amendments that I would like to point out that do that, that we object to. First of all, on page 1, line 16.
Mr. Chair.
Which amendment? Representative Simmons.
Are you referencing the dash 22 amendments?
I am, please. Sir.
Proceed.
Thank you. So we're on page 1, line 16 of the dash 22 amendments. And this is the definition of municipal utility. Instead of being simply the definition that was in the original bill, which is that a municipal utility is a entity that's organized under the municipal utility statute, the definition has been expanded to a municipal utility is an entity that is either organized under or is owned or operated by or on behalf of a city, which permits a municipal utility to basically take and transfer or to bring an entity in and do some contracting. In other words, it permits a municipal utility to bring in a private contractor and compete with the utility. It essentially expands the power of a municipal utility beyond that which is currently in the statutes. Given the fact that this bill gives an awful lot to consumer-owned utilities, we're quite concerned about the expansion of the definition of municipal utility under this statute.
Let me interrupt you there. Is there any municipal utility which operates a utility today delivering electric power that they do not directly operate? I mean, so I'm just curious in terms, as you say, and I don't think by adding this definition in the context of this is going to change their powers, because that's going to be covered under other chapters in terms of their ability to operate and what they can and can't do. But in terms of, I'm just curious, is there any entity today that is being a municipal utility which is being operated by a private firm?
Well, I'm sure the municipal utility representatives in the room could answer that question more thoroughly and with greater background than I could, but as I understand it, this is an expansion of the definition of municipal utility under current law. So that's our first concern. Our next concern is on page 6, line 16 of the Dash 22 amendments.
I'm sorry, what was the page number?
Page 6, line 16. And this pertains to the reciprocity.
16.
Line 16 on page 6. And this amendment amends the reciprocity provision in the bill. This provision attempted to create some level of equity between consumer-owned and investor-owned utilities when the consumer-owned utility sought to compete in the investor-owned utility's service territory. And this definition, or this amendment to the reciprocity provision, in our amendment, in our opinion, excuse me, weakens the reciprocity provision that came over from the Senate, and we oppose that amendment on that basis. Finally, on page, finally in this particular area, on page 7, lines 4 and lines 12, there are two provisions that amend the section 27 of the bill, which is the public purpose charge for consumer-owned utilities. One of our amendments and the Dash 16 amendments is an amendment to make the public purpose charge for public utilities the same as the public purpose charge for private utilities. This amendment goes the other direction and makes the public purpose charge for public utilities sort of even less of a charge than the charge currently is. So instead of evening the playing field, which is what our amendments suggest, these amendments make the public purpose charge for COUs even less than it is currently. So we would object to those amendments on that basis as well. The final concern that we have about the...
I'm trying to track what you're saying, and I understand page 7 and then lines 4 and then lines 12, and you're talking about public service, and I look back, I understand you're dealing with the Dash 22 amendments, if I can think that I'm looking where you're at, and you're talking about public service, and I'm not seeing that aspect there, and I'm also, as we're trying to go, and you're going at speed in relation to you having a look there, but these are amendments of the corpus, which I'm going to also bring it back to, and well, what you just said about, you know, public purpose, I'm not finding, you know, in the Dash 22 amendments. I guess I can give a little help.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, the amendments on page 7, lines 4 and lines 12 amend section 27 of the bill. Section 27 of the bill is the public purpose charge for consumer-owned utilities.
Okay. I'm there. So okay. How is that doing that?
In the amendment beginning on page 4, which says in line 15, it defines revenues as not including any of the costs or credits that are potentially available to the public utility and other sections of the bill or other sections of that particular provision. And it's not so much that we oppose that provision on its substantive merits. It's simply that is a difference from the charge that is currently being imposed on IOUs, and one that makes the charge ultimately less for COU customers than for IOU customers. And that's a concern that we have in terms of just why it is that two customer classes are going to be paying different fees when this bill is passed. That's something that we don't think that's a good public policy result for all kinds of reasons that we've stated in our testimony. And instead of evening it, which we propose to do in our amendments, these amendments go the other direction.
Let me have you jump back to the ones on page 6, the amendment. I was just trying to read the amendment as it would read. In what are we trying to do here? I mean, I understand you're not trying to do it, but what's the practical effect? Can you describe in terms of what the practical effect of on page 6, line 16, the amendment's there? What's the practical effect of this at the end of the day?
It's our view that the practical effect of this is to make it easier for consumer-owned utilities to compete in IOU service territories without offering the same privileges to IOUs or others who want to compete in their service territory. So in other words, it's more of a ring fencing or a way of protecting their service territory in a way that isn't evenly applied to IOUs and COUs. So those are the three concerns that we have with respect to public-private disparities in the bill and the fact that these amendments, we think, exacerbate that. We have a concern with respect to the subsidy issue, and we appreciate the fact that the coalition put some language in the bill to try to address that issue, because it's an issue that we have great concern about and one that we testified to at least a couple times before this committee. While representatives of the coalition indicate that they have made this crystal clear that there is not going to be any rate shock, we don't think that this gets there. And in fact, we think that the amendments we've submitted in the Dash 16 amendments actually get to a resolution of this issue. You know, you can't just say there shouldn't be rate shock without talking about how you get there. And the fact that was our concern about what was in the bill previously, which simply said you shouldn't have cost shifting. We don't think this gets very much further. Now it says you shouldn't have rate shock, or the commission can take steps to mitigate rate shock. It still doesn't talk about how that happened. And we think, as we said in our amendments, that the committee ought to be express about that. They ought to say that either the subsidy goes away before direct access, and that's why we propose to push back the direct access date by 15 months to make that happen, make that possible, or the bill ought to specifically say that the subsidy can be continued on in the distribution rates of direct access customers. In other states where PacifiCorp has been involved in restructuring legislation, this has been a huge issue, just a huge issue before you get to direct access. When you go about unbundling rates, everybody fights about what happens to that. In our rates, it's currently a 10% subsidy that commercial and industrial customers are paying to residential ratepayers. And what you do with that becomes an issue of great contention in the process of getting from here to there. And we think that it's bad public policy not to talk about how that issue ought to be handled, and we don't think these amendments get there. And we think that our amendment, which says that the subsidy shall be removed prior to direct access and gives the PUC an additional 15 months to do it, is a preferable option to just more kind of general language about the issue.
Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, absent pushing off the date, if you could flesh out the other idea that you had in terms of, if not pushing the date back, how you deal with, I guess, a debatable question of subsidy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deckard, I think there's a few ways to do it. We've proposed pushing off the date and making express that subsidies should be eliminated. Another way to do it is to say that subsidies may be continued in the distribution rates of direct access customers. That would be the way to do it. Otherwise, you're going to get the direct access customers coming in and saying, we're not required to pay this. This says costs should be unbundled, and we should be paying a distribution rate that reflects the cost of distribution services, not some subsidy left over from previous rate-making days. So, I mean, the reason we are concerned about it is that we've been there before in other states, and we think we're going to go there in this state because of the 10% disparity between cost of service rates and actual costs. I mean, between actual costs and the rates that residential customers pay, that's currently reflected in our rates.
Sure. I guess a better question would have been, how would you respond to Mr. Ekus's assertion or answer to that same exact question in terms of how one might deal with this issue?
Well, my understanding of is what the commission has said on this issue. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Deckert. My understanding is what the commission has said on this issue is that they think that if there is an issue, they can address it through their general powers, which I assume is a statement that they think that they could perpetrate it in distribution rates without express language to that effect. We haven't seen the industrial customer groups say, yeah, sure, we agree that they have that power. And in fact, in other states, they always say they don't. They say that the distribution rate should reflect the actual cost of distribution services. And especially when you have language in this bill that indicates that that's the case, we're quite concerned that when this bill is passed, we're going to have a big fight about where that subsidy gets paid. And, our interests here are both to avoid that contentiousness and also to avoid the situation where, because it can't go in distribution rates and the commission wants to avoid rate shock, that the utility shareholders end up absorbing that subsidy as a cost of the implementation of direct access. So that's why it's important to us that the issue be expressly dealt with. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to run up? Welcome.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Weiss. I work with the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, which is one of the members of the broad coalition that supports these amendments. I would like to address the previous witness, Catherine's, pointing out that there has been a there is an inequity in the amendment on how the consumer-owned utilities are calculated to 3% compared to how the IOU are calculated. And I have the, and I think it was just a drafting error, I have the paper that we submitted to the LC, which calculates it the same way as the IOU did, and then what came out of LC doesn't have a phrase. And so I think perhaps there was just a drafting mistake. What was submitted to LC has the phrase on page 16 of the printed bill, line 15, it says it's the amount collected by the consumer-owned utility or energy service supplier, whereas in the amendments, which the A22 amendments, which you're considering, that phrase...
What page? Amendments?
Page 7 of the amendments, line 5. Page 7 of the amendments, line 5, reads, by the consumer-owned utility from its retail electric consumers. After the word utility, there should be the phrase, or energy service supplier. See, the situation is, and then that makes it equal. See, the situation is that customers will be out on the market buying from someone else, and how is the 3% calculated? And it was always meant in the IOU and the COU to be equal. It would be calculated on their total bill. The total bill is the combination of what they're buying from the utility and what they're buying from the market supplier. And so the that phrase, or energy service supplier, has been left out of what was submitted to LC. So I would ask that it be put back in or whatever.
Representative King?
Gary.
So I have a question. Maybe it's a question for staff. I was wondering if energy service supplier, you know, needs to be defined in the bill. I don't see it in our definition.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I'm sorry, electricity service supplier. You're right.
That's defined.
Electricity service supplier. I misspoke.
Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, can you please read the sentence as you intended it or as the coalition?
So as the coalition intended on page 7 of the amendments, line 5, after the word, it should read, by the consumer-owned utility or electricity service supplier. From its electricity, from its retail electricity consumers. And I think Gary would concur, and so on. It was just a drafting error. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to come? Welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. The answer to your question is that there are no municipal utilities currently operating that have contracted out the operation of the municipal electric utility function. But certainly, municipal electric utility owning the poles and wires were to, you know, contract out the operation. That would be within the scope of this definition and would be, and was, as was in the bill that was last session, I think, in 2018.
So do you agree that that is an expansion of authority today? Do you have the ability to do that today?
Mr. Chair, I believe we have the authority to do that today.
Okay.
Contracting statute.
Can you give us the reference in terms of where that is in statute?
Thanks.
Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, there's a quick question, if I may. And what is the rationale between the differential treatment between the COUs and the IOUs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deckard. When we first started talking about the public purposes charges some time ago, in fact, we're back at the regional review, comprehensive review, there was a recognition that that the consumer-owned utilities were looking for the flexibility to collect the 3% and make sure that those collect that locally, have the flexibility to determine the programs locally, and as I say, spend it locally. The bill reflects that approach. The bill, as was part of the agreement, says that when the public purpose charge for the consumer-owned utilities would kick in when the consumer-owned utility authorizes direct access under the provisions of the bill. It is kicked in on a class-by-class basis since that's the way we can authorize direct access. So it's designed to ensure that that no class of customers would pay the public purpose charge unless they were receiving direct access as a benefit under the bill. But it is structured in such a way that the local elected, again, going back to that basic parallel structure that's in the bill, that for the investment-owned utilities, the PUC, the body, determines how those funds are spent. For the consumer-owned utilities, the local elected officials in the community determine how those funds are spent. But it's still 3% of electric services.
And Mr. Pollock, please.
Representative Decker.
And how about the issue of annexation or the possibility of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Decker, we've had PacifiCorps, I think, has raised some concerns about annexations. I guess I would respond by saying that ever since the 1880s, when municipal utilities were first formed, the people of this state have had the right to either form a municipal utility or join to or be part of a municipal electric utility. That's the kind of competition between public and private power that we've had since the 1800s, and I guess we would argue that it's resulted in a, it was a healthy competition, it's been a healthy competition that has benefited the state as a whole. This bill, and up until now, up until this bill, the only choice, if you will, that a customer of an investor-owned utility would have, or residents of a community served by, would be that they would either have to form a new utility or join to another utility. This bill now offers another option, which is they may choose, they would still be with the distribution utility, but they could now choose their electric service provider, which is something they have not been able to do before. So this bill now provides another route, a safety valve, if you will. It wasn't there before. We don't feel that the Pacific Core approach with annexations is therefore necessary, and we're concerned about it. I mean, we have basically right now municipal utilities. We have agreements with the various utilities that we border about how those territories are transferred. I guess I'd add that, as finally, as far as municipal utilities are concerned, just speaking for myself, I have, I think, four municipal utilities that border Pacific Core. I'm not quite sure of the huge competitive threat of Milton Freewater or Ashland or a little bit abandoned Monmouth and Cascade Lot.
And perhaps just briefly, is it fair competition, the competition that you spoke of? Would it be fair under the provisions in 2002 or 2003 under this bill?
Under this bill?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deglin, I mean, yes. I guess I would say that there has never been, if you're asking me, is there a level playing field, the proverbial level playing field, there has never been, at least to my knowledge, a level playing field in this industry since the beginning of time. It's always tilting one, you know, back and forth a little bit. We each have different strengths and different liabilities, if you will. We operate under the open meetings law. We operate with elected officials making those decisions under, and so on. They don't.
Elected officials?
Pardon me?
I mean,
but, so it, I think each has different strength and resources that the other may not have.
Tom, let me jump in here for a second. You spoke eloquently of the municipals and PUDs as safety valves to protect. In terms of, as I read this bill, you're not going. There's no opportunity for anybody in your territory to opt out if they feel that you're not providing good service to them. So why is it good for the goose but not for the gander here in this case?
Mr. Chair, 2 points, I guess, and because I think that was a two-part question. Right now, with any publicly owned utility, and that continues under this bill, that utility customers have, that's one, to throw the corporate board, the elected officials out at any time they want to under the under referendum and recall. They have the ability to put any of our budgets or ordinances up for referendum and recall. They have the ability to get, and they have the ability, if they want to say, we're tired of these guys. It's time to, this thing isn't economical anymore, and we're going to dissolve it. They can do that. The voters can do that, I guess. And that authority is there under this bill either way. Second part of your question, this bill is not, we were not looking for an opt-in or an opt-out. The reason we were looking for local control under this bill is so that the community could have the flexibility to design a system that works for them best. If it was a straight opt-in, opt-out, in other words, we either had a choice of sitting on our hands and doing nothing, or opting into what we would call a cookie-cutter approach that was designed for the big utilities, that, I think, in our mind, pushes you in the direction probably of doing nothing. If, on the other hand, the local board has the ability to design the system that works best for them, then they can respond to the community conditions. I'll give you one quick example. If the city of Cascade Locks, 500 customers, had to go to a portfolio approach to implement, if that was, they had to, their only choice was to do nothing or opt into that, that would clobber them in terms of the kind of computer structure and all the kinds of things that they would have to put in place. So what this does is give the flexibility to design a system that works for them.
But I guess, Tom, in terms of that's majority rules, what if you have a customer, a big, large industrial concern sitting out in your territory, who says, if I went to market, I could be more competitive? And in, under this plan, they don't get to make that choice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, that's true. This is not a one individual gets to make the decision. That is true.
Except in the investor-owned utilities, the individual gets to make the choice whether they want to leave the system or not leave the system.
As defined under the rules by the PUC. I think the reason that we're here today in at least a neutral situation is that we got this far is we tried to design something that we thought we could work with our industrial customers. We know that they need to be able to respond to some of those conditions in the international market. We believe that this gives us the flexibility to work with them. We think we have a good track record in doing that. I guess, again, the people who are on those local elected boards are elected from the community. They're members of the Chamber of Commerce, or they're members of, you know, they're part of the community. And we feel that that's a community decision.
But I guess, Tom, as I look at this, you know, and I see in terms of what the Supreme Court is talking about, you want to be able to sit off and pick off the big, or the ability to pick off big electric users, bring them into your system, deliver energy to them, but not have the risk of the other side going in. You want to be able to pick off and get them, but you don't want to risk them coming up and getting any more of your customers to go the other direction, only to the extent of what you pick off. So you've got the safety valve, and your risk is limited very narrowly here, where the risk on the other side of the equation is wide open. And as I see this, and this is my concern in this issue, is that we create an imbalance in terms of where the residential customer is the one who's going to be sitting at the end of this without any choices, and they're the ones going to bear the brunt of everybody else's choice to go, and they're the ones that are going to be left holding the bag on the system because they don't get to play in this marketplace in terms of, and everybody gets to go and gets to be competitive, and but the consumer sits back and bears all the risk ultimately.
Mr. Chair, the reciprocity provision in the bill is reflected in the Dash 22s, the consensus amendments, says that if a consumer-owned utility chooses to serve outside its service territory, then to a customer, then that to a non-residential customer, then it would have to release or give open access to customers of that same size or larger outside, in its own service territory. That's the reciprocity provision.
And so if you pick off a very large customer and then you have no customers who are that larger, then what happens?
If we were serving a very large customer and we had no comparable size under that language, no, that would not, then the cost would not kick in.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I just want to find out on this Section 45 whose brilliant language this was, in terms of I've never seen this before, and I'm just curious as to why it's here in the Dash 22 amendments. Who wants to come and talk about that? Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Finlayson, and I represent Portland General Electric. my colleagues here will talk about the I call it the death bill clause, but then I'll talk about the clauses after that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jason Eisdorf for Citizens Utility Board. We're looking at dash 822, page 8, where it says section 45, the first paragraph. One of the binding ties that was holding the coalition together is a linkage between direct access and public purposes. There was some concern, I suppose, that individually each of those issues are challengeable in court. It may be that that direct access itself and potentially stranded cost issue may be challengeable. On the other side, there are potential liabilities on the public purposes side, and what the coalition decided was it probably wasn't a good idea to strand one of those issues out there all by itself, because we had linked them as a coalition. So the concept of paragraph one is that the bill as a whole is a whole, and if any single provision were challenged, that the intent of the bill was pretty much thwarted, and so any section were to be found unconstitutional or unlawful, that it would affect the entire bill. We got this language out of DOJ, Oregon Department of Justice manual.
Okay. Representative Crummell.
As I read it, I found it a little bit interesting, because usually you have a severability clause in a lot of the acts that we have gone through, so that if any part is found to be unconstitutional, it doesn't affect the rest of the bill. Would you care to address why you just thought it was a good idea? I mean, I heard you say that it was a good idea to link everything together, but is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, in fact, I think there's a provision in state law that says if you're silent on this issue, that the severability clause does apply to the legislation, and so if you challenge a section of a statute, it doesn't affect the rest of the statute. Again, the reason we went this is because the coalition understood that this was really a group effort, and the things that we attached to each other were really to go as a whole. We didn't want to leave any particular section or concept out there hanging by itself.
Thank you. Thank you. You want to talk about
the... Mr. Chairman, yes. The rest of the bill actually addresses protection for the utility that has in good faith expended dollars to get to a certain point. And should this bill die at any point, maybe 3 years later, and our only challenge is then to get to kill whatever we've done, we've expended money and resources, we want to be able to recover those that have been prudently incurred, and it's really protection for the utility that if this bill dies, that we get to recover whatever costs we've expended on it.
Yeah, I asked in terms of on page 9, line 9, the definition or an example of arrangements with third parties necessary to allow the company to provide electricity service, and how much that might be, that's the risk that we're putting on ratepayers?
Essentially, we have no idea. That's why we need the protection. We have no idea how much this could cost, and certainly there will be third-party transactions as we work with energy service suppliers. And so whatever it takes to put in systems to bill for those people or to calculate or to do load management, and if we get out of, I mean, if all of this goes away and we have to go back to the way we're operating today, we certainly want to be able to recover the costs that we have incurred to get to the point we were before the bill died.
So,
I don't have any numbers for you because we don't know right now.
So, if I'm reading this correctly, then the ratepayers risk, they're the full cost of opening up a competitive market.
Absolutely.
And risks that they would not otherwise have to take or be responsible for if we are successful, because you'll recover them in your market rates, but
in the failure of a single provision of this bill, the ratepayers will bear the entire burden of going to a competitive market.
That's true.
Thank you.
Can Jason respond to Representative Hill's point?
Mr. Chair, I guess I wouldn't have answered it that way. You're setting up a dichotomy where we would not pay if the bill goes through, but we would pay if this kicks in. And my assessment is that customers are going to pay for the transition.
Residential customers wouldn't.
There are costs, Mr. Chair, there are costs in setting up the portfolio that we are going to pay for.
Oh, so residential rates are going to go up then? To provide this portfolio. I thought that we were going to have a market. We weren't going to see rates go up.
The intent, obviously, Mr. Chair, is not to raise rates. And any time you fiddle with the system, there are going to be new costs. Hopefully, there will be costs that we can avoid by doing this. That's what restructuring is about. There are going to be new costs in going toward a new structure. One point I think I would like to add to this is that what the totality of this section does is if there is a challenge to one portion of the bill, essentially all the coalition members are going to be on the same side in court trying to overcome that challenge. In addition, we'll know pretty soon whether or not any particular section is challenged, and I would argue before the Public Utility Commission that as we go through adding or changing the system over, which might create some cost, that we be mindful of the challenge and do it on a time frame that takes that challenge into account, so that if it looks like it's going to be a successful challenge, we not go very aggressively towards restructuring.
You have an uphill battle with me on that. Representative McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe at the next meeting, whenever that may be, if you have an idea how much this new tax will be and how much the rate will increase the telephone bill when we impose a new tax on all residentials, that is something we can get.
Electric bill. Different bill.
On tax on electric bill, yes. Yeah. Is that a number you have handy, or could we have it for the next meeting?
And which?
The Dash 23 amendment.
We'll try to get you that.
Thank you. Representative Montgomery, just, I have requested a revenue analysis of the bill, which should provide us. I will go talk to the aides. I have requested that we get analysis to understand how much the 3% collects in each of those categories. We get a legislative revenue analysis of that. That was not done in the Senate side.
Thank you.
So that is my intention that we see that before we move on. Yes, Representative.
Yes. Thank you, Cindy. And Mason can answer that, but along the lines of what you were asking, it does look to me like we're silent upon, and I think the recovery is fair, but it does look like it's silent upon who the recovery is collected upon. So, it does look like we could have, exposure to cost that could benefit people who do want more direct access, who have aggregation, but that there would be cost, and since it's silent, then that cost recovery could be upon, across the broad spectrum of ratepayers, not just those who are
choosing to go.
The way the bill is written, it's essentially punted to the PUC, so they would make that determination.
We like to make some choices.
So if I could be clear, that you're saying that the clause among the seven, where it does be in the public interest, that it means that we kick back to the PUC and then they would make it.
They would make the determination of what the recovery is and whether or not it was prudently incurred in the public interest.
Representative Rizzo,
I'm not for this panel.
Representative Crummel, this is our last panel. Representative Crummel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the non-severability clauses, Section 45. You mentioned that there, in putting this thing together, putting together a portfolio, going out to market, and so on and so forth, that there will be new costs. But I would assume that there's also going to be new efficiencies in that as well. So if that's the case, of course, if you never get to market with those, then of course the cost side is not. Balanced by the efficiency side or the lower rates and all the other good stuff that's supposed to come out of this thing. Do you want to address that at all? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Crumbull, I think that's probably a fair assessment. I think it was one of our positions that paragraph one means that all of us together are trying very hard to win any challenge in court. And so, in fact, the point is that we're trying to get to the point where there are new efficiencies. And by us all hanging together rather than falling apart, where it's more likely that we'll get there than otherwise.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have one more question, if I may. This is one that's just kind of eating on me, and I've heard that, and maybe this is when it's better to shut up, but actually I've heard that Pacific Corps evidently or didn't want to participate in the coalition and then decided that they would participate. Have they participated in these amendments, and give me a little assessment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, we have had discussions with Pacific Corp, significant discussions with them over the last couple of weeks, trying to address some of their issues.
But this has been going on for a couple of years.
That's correct. And for a couple of years, we have not been able to reach consensus with the universe of interests that are out there. And in this particular case, Pacific Corp is now in the universe that's not in this coalition. But we have been having discussions with them as late as 1 o'clock this afternoon. I think it's fair to say that at this point, it's not clear that they're going to join this coalition. I think that's a fair statement. And I think the chair is going to address the Dash 16 amendments, which are Pacific Corps amendments, at a later time, in which that issue will become more clear.
Representative Crummell, if I might just jump in. We don't hold anybody accountable for not participating in anybody else's private activities elsewhere outside. Pacific Corps has participated in this process while this bill has been before the legislature. And that's what we need to be concerned about. They have been here. They don't agree with this coalition, and we get to make that choice.
Sure.
Representative Montgomery?
Just last question, and I promise no more. Just so my question wasn't misunderstood, I'll put it in my language.
Okay.
My mother lives in Beaverton. She's 89 years old. She pays her own bills, always has, always will. All the programs on earth are available. She's more conservative than I am. How much is her electricity going to go up if I vote yes on this bill? So that's what I'd like to ask you on Friday, if you can help me out. How much is my mother's electric bill going to go up if I vote yes on this new tax for her? And I don't care about all the programs that are available. She will never avail herself of them. She'll starve to death first. God bless her. So please help me out on that number. That's all I need.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montgomery, there's no assurance it will go up at all. No assurance at all that your mother's electricity bill will go up in this bill.
The Dash 23 amendment says we'll charge a fee, so maybe I misread it. I just didn't understand.
Well, the rest of the bill has a 3% charge that your mother would have to pay, plus an additional fee. I don't know what the percentage is that makes up the $10 million, and this is just imposing that $5 million of the $10 million earlier than they otherwise would have.
Well, that's more than she should pay. She don't have to pay it. She's already paid her bill.
If I could point out, the 1997 electrical consumption order was about 2.6 million. If you take 10 million divided by 2.6 million.
Representative King, this would only be over the two utility districts, which would be Pacific Corps and PG&E. So you wouldn't be able to use
that. And the direct, but the outside would also.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you. I realize that we're out of time for today, but I would like to request a response to Pacific for testimony, specifically their point that the original bill doesn't adequately protect residential ratepayers. I think that's a pretty profound criticism that's quite troubling to me. Mm-hmm. And we really haven't had testimony on that point. I think it's the very beginning of the hearing. So,
who would you like it from?
I think that he should respond to that.
Okay. Let's, Mr. Higgins, if you could prepare something for Friday in terms of on that issue, and then we are out of time today, and then we can take that issue up on Friday. Okay. Any other requests so we can get people so that we get what we need for our Friday meeting? Hearing seen? Okay. Without objection, we'll close the work session, and without objection, we adjourn.